This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Scott Black. He's executive director of the Xerces Society, and we're here to talk about monarch butterflies and all kinds of related issues. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk. I mean, your organization is all about protection not only of monarch butterflies, but all kinds of creatures, pollinators, invertebrates. And monarch butterflies are kind of maybe, what would you call it, a charismatic species that, because they're so beautiful, people tend to care about them.
Yeah, there are charismatic microfauna is what we call it. Most wildlife conservation organizations have a charismatic megafauna, whether it's a, you know, the Bengal tiger or the polar bear. You know, we have animals like the Salt Creek tiger beetle and the Moro shoulder band snail that we work to conserve. And so when you have an animal like a monarch butterfly, you can really use it as a rallying cry for all of the bottom of the food chain.
Meanwhile, it's important to think of all of these different species because they all form an ecosystem, and it's not that one is really more important than any of the others in many cases.
Well, and that's really true. So if you like to eat salmon, you can thank a small fly in the stream where it grew up. If you like to watch birds, you can thank the insects that they ate to or fed their young. If you like to, in many cases, fish or hunt, for instance, waterfowl, you can thank the insects that they used as sustenance. So these animals and all of these animals really are the fabric that keeps life on the planet what it is today.
And that's basically a kind of what you're talking about is food webs. These animals eat other animals who in turn eat other animals, and all of those are necessary.
And all of them are necessary. And we're talking food webs in multiple senses. One, you know, in Xerces Society is funny is we try to conserve animals that we hope will be eaten by other animals, which is kind of a funny way to think about it. But also food webs in that these invertebrates perform incredibly valuable ecosystem services such as pollination. We, bees, butterflies, other animals pollinate over 80% of all plants on the planet, which without these insects and other pollinators, we wouldn't have those plants. You know, parasitoids and predators help control the pests of crops. On and on and on and on. Freshwater mussels actually help clean water. They filter the water and clean it. And this is, you could just go on and on and on. And then also to think that there are almost a million known insects on the planet. They make up over 95% of all animal life. Insects and other invertebrates do. And so when you think about the contribution with how many of them are out there, you can really realize why E.O. Wilson says, you know, if we lose insects and their allies, life on this planet will collapse. If we lose humans, no other animal will blink an eye.
Very interesting. So that said, let's talk about monarch butterflies. Monarch butterflies are these beautiful species that migrate very long distances. They're found all over the United States. They go, what are they, summer in Mexico?
Yes. Well, we have two populations of monarch butterflies that I can talk about, but the majority and the monarchs east of the Rockies, for the most part, overwinter in fir forests north of Mexico City. And then in the spring, they fly by the millions and up to Texas, Oklahoma. They will lay eggs there. The monarchs that overwinter die. than the monarchs that feed on milkweed. That's the only plant they'll eat. So the eggs are laid on milkweed. The caterpillars eat and eat and eat and grow and then become what's called a chrysalis. And then emerge as this beautiful butterfly. They continue north and continue east. And we may see two or three more generations going that way up into Iowa, up into Minnesota, all the way up into Canada. And then the last generation, who's never been to Mexico, flies 2,000, sometimes 2,500 miles back to the same overwintering sites. It's amazing. In the West, we have a shorter migration. We've got sites along the California coast, about 100 overwintering sites, and it's very similar. Well, they'll fly, lay eggs, mostly in California, and then make their way to the Great Basin, up into Montana, up into Idaho. Regardless, it's magical that an animal that has never seen its overwintering site, and that overwintering site might be 2,000 miles away, can fly and find it.
Is it known how they find it?
It's not truly known. We know how they orient themselves to fly south, but nobody truly knows how they get back to the same places they started.
So what do they need in order to survive? Because, I mean, populations of monarch butterflies have dropped precipitously, and it's very scary for them, and it's very scary in a number of ways. But what is it that a monarch butterfly needs when it's, you know, at its very first stages and then throughout its life?
Yeah, you know, it's actually very simple. Just like us, monarch butterflies need something to eat, and they need safe places to be. What this means is one, milkweed. It's the only plant. We have a variety of milkweed, by the way, several dozen species in the United States, but those milkweeds are the only type of plants that monarchs will eat. And the adults have to find a milkweed, and they have to lay their egg on that milkweed. That milkweed is there. The caterpillars eat it and eat it and eat it and go through several instars. And as I said, a pupate, and beautiful chrysalis, and then emerge as adults again. And as they travel, one of the things that monarchs need, because they're such strong and widespread flyers, is nectar sources. All butterflies, or most butterflies, feed on nectar, but monarchs likely need much, much more of that nectar because they have to fly. They have to fuel their flight. So milkweed for the larva, nectar sources for the adults. And then when I say safe places, we have to be careful about pesticides because, you know, especially insecticides kill insects, and monarchs are insects. And so if you're using insecticides and those insecticides get on, or in some cases in the host plant or in the nectar sources, this can be a huge problem.
What is the role of the monarch butterfly in the greater ecosystem?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's sometimes hard to peg the ecosystem role of an animal. That said, In its heyday, there were likely a billion monarchs. And although monarchs actually are somewhat toxic, many animals still eat them. So from birds to mice to beetles and wasps, all of these animals would have gained sustenance from this billion-odd monarchs. Monarchs also do carry pollen. They don't pollinate any crops, but they likely do pollinate some plants as they move around and collect and sip nectar. So very important in those ways. And then I would contend very important from beyond an ecosystem as a real classroom for humans to really see the natural world. Almost everybody in the United States has seen a monarch. And if you ask people to name a butterfly, it's likely a monarch. And I think that's important as a as a bridge to talk about the other animals, other butterflies and other insects and other invertebrates that are also part of the ecosystem.
That said, it's less likely that a first grader today will have seen a monarch than that you and I, when we were first graders, have seen a monarch.
It's much less likely. We have seen a 90%, almost a 90% decline in monarchs in the eastern United States and a 50% decline in the western United States. And this was really brought home to me. I grew up in Nebraska, and I took my family back for the summer or for a few weeks in the summer, and really just realized that we had to search to see monarchs. We had to really look. And when I was growing up, they were everywhere. You would, in the summertime, in July, in Nebraska, you almost couldn't not see a monarch. And that's no longer the case.
And why is that?
Well, there are a variety of reasons. There have been issues with logging in Mexico at the overwintering sites, and I'm pleased to say that the Mexican government is really working to limit that logging and has done a good job with that.
Because they care about monarchs?
Because they care about monarchs, yes. The Mexican government, because they care about monarchs, and because monarchs in Mexico also mean dollars. It's a tourist industry that's built around the monarch butterfly. So we've been very pleased with the Mexican government actually taking action on the logging. There are still issues, and it's still a potential problem. And we need the government to stay strong and continue to work to curb that illegal logging. But we've come a long way there.
Of course, it's not just Mexico that is threatening monarchs.
That is certainly the case. And I started with the logging to sort of get that out of the way. But the real, whatever you call it, the 2,000-pound gorilla in the room is really industrial agriculture in the Midwest. With the advent of large monocultural crops, and especially the use of glyphosate-resistant corn and soybeans, we've seen a 90-plus percent decline in milkweed in the upper Midwest. And that is what people think is really one of the leading factors that has really affected monarchs.
Now, when you say glyphosate, that is Monsanto Roundup?
Yes. So some people would call them Roundup Ready crops. And the issue is that it's actually not the crops that's causing the problem. It's then the use of glyphosate or Roundup on those crops. So when you have a quote-unquote Roundup Ready corn, what that means is it's genetically engineered so that the herbicide Roundup actually won't kill it. And so you can then spray that herbicide in and around those crops to control all of the weeds. Well, some of the weeds, not a huge problematic weeds, but some of the weeds in corn and soybean are milkweed. And several studies have shown that those milkweeds in and around ag areas have just severely declined. And this, like our breadbasket, this was the breadbasket for monarchs. This is where monarchs really, the final two generations of bread. And these are the generations, the last generation to go back to Mexico. And when you lose that milkweed, you really do see impacts to monarchs.
We're talking to Scott Black, Executive Director of the Xerces Society. In theory, would agriculture be compatible with having, you know, milkweed nearby?
Yes, we believe so. You know, actually, until the advent of Roundup Ready corn and soy, milkweed was always found in and among corn, and we raised a lot of corn, and it really wasn't a huge issue.
When you say we raised a lot of corn?
Well, we, the United States. So when I say we, I'm thinking the proverbial we. I mean, a lot of corn was raised even before the advent of Roundup Ready crops, and cropping systems weren't perfect. They were often still too large, still monocultural. Which means the monoculture simply is that you're growing one crop over large blocks of habitat. So we really do believe that we're not shooting to have milkweed in and amongst corn or soybeans, but we can work with farmers all over the United States to really bring a little bit of wildness back in and adjacent to these crop areas and protect those plants from herbicides as well as insecticides, and we really believe that we do have a way forward to bring back the monarchs.
So what are you actually doing to bring back the monarchs? What kind of activities? I know that when I was listening to you talk before, you said something along the lines of 25 years ago, the number of people who were interested in monarch butterfly conservation, you could fit around a kitchen table. Now, many, many people are working on monarch butterflies. What are they doing? What are you doing?
Yeah, and I said that really in the context of pollinators overall. You know, there were not very many people back in the 1990s or before working on pollinators and specifically monarchs. There were incredible people like Karen Oberhauser at the University of Minnesota and some others who were really work on monarchs and educating the public about the how magnificent and wonderful they were. But what's really happened over the last 20 years is, and some of this is due to really the decline in these animals, both bees, honeybees with their issues, native bees, and monarchs. We've really seen an outpouring of support for our conservation efforts. And it really, it's culminated this year in actually the President of the United States talking about pollinators, talking about monarchs, and actually getting his agencies to all take action to protect pollinators, including monarchs. And it's pretty neat when you see the President of the United States talking about an insect. And even beyond that, 2 years ago, both the President of the United States and Mexico, as well as the Prime Minister of Canada, had a meeting where they discussed specifically monarchs and how the three countries could work together towards monarch conservation, because it is really a three-country issue, because they're migrating all the way from Canada down to Mexico.
Insects know no national boundaries.
That's right. Just like with all wildlife, they don't care whether it's a state boundary, a national boundary, or anything else.
So what does one actually do to basically, I mean, what is it that you need? You need milkweed to be growing in the places where they are living or migrating to and from. How do you encourage milkweed?
Yeah, so you need milkweed for monarchs, and you need diverse nectar sources. And I always like to make sure I give the plug for the nectar sources, because monarchs cannot live on milkweed alone. And really what we need are diverse plantings, flowering plantings with milkweed. And we need to protect those areas from insecticides, including the herbicides like glyphosate. And the one thing I didn't mention, you know, beyond logging in Mexico and beyond glyphosate-resistant crops, is that insecticides generally are also likely having an impact on monarchs. And we've got a new class of insecticides called neonicotinoids, which may be a real part of the problem.
Those are scary.
Neonicotinoids are really a cause for concern. They're a new class of insecticide that are different from a lot of the older classes in that, you know, all insecticides are made to be toxic to insects, so they're similar in that way. But these are systemic, so once you apply them to a plant, they're taken into every plant part, the roots, the leaves, the shoots, and the pollen and nectar. And even more concerning, they're much more persistent than older classes of chemicals, sometimes years after a single application in a plant, 2 years in soil. So these are a real problem for bees, for butterflies, and certainly monarchs included.
Meanwhile, there's also just huge amounts of habitat loss. I heard you talk about how much land is being lost every day and how much has been lost in the last several years to real estate development, energy development, things like that, and that affects monarchs.
That affects monarchs. It affects all wildlife out there. And we need to, number one, protect the landscapes that remain. I mean, my mantra is that it makes no sense to continue to destroy habitat and then try to create new habitat for these animals. We need to protect the habitat that remains. We need to manage it for monarchs and other pollinators. And then we've already lost a lot of habitat, so we still need to be doing a great amount of restoration to ensure that the base of the food chain is taken care of. So that we're taken care of.
How much land, how much habitat is being lost every year, every day?
Well, according to a recent report, we're losing somewhere around 5,000 acres a day, over 5,000 acres a day. And we've also lost millions of acres of land to production in agriculture. Since 2008, we've seen land conversion in an order of magnitude that we haven't seen since the Dust Bowl. So we are really continuing to, both in urban and in agricultural landscapes, destroy habitat. And we need to figure out how we can continue to produce the crops that we need without destroying the last of what remains.
I mean, these are big and complex questions because some of that land is being used to grow corn for ethanol, and in theory, there could be really different energy policy that's more renewable than ethanol, and that land could be preserved as habitat.
That is exactly right. A lot of the land that we've lost to agriculture production is specifically because of ethanol. And when you look at the monarch, I do find it really interesting that the demise of the monarch can be tied, not exclusively, but a major factor is ethanol, corn syrup, and cows. The vast majority of the corn grown in this country is used for either ethanol production, the production of corn syrup, or as feed for cattle. And I just find it interesting that trifecta is really one of the main causes of monarch decline.
And when you think about all of those things, I mean, moving toward a solar, wind, and renewable-based energy policy, moving toward, to the extent that we are eating beef, eating grass-fed beef that is produced on healthy landscapes, and maybe we don't need to drink so much high fructose corn syrup. I mean, a lot of these things, they're not necessities the way that growing good, healthy food is a necessity.
Yeah, I think that monarch decline is tied hand in hand also with obesity, with a healthy populace, because we don't need to be drinking so much corn syrup. And as in with any other countries in the world, we can have our portion sizes of meat be smaller and move towards grass-fed and, include the healthy fruits and vegetables that we should all be eating. And if we did that, we would really help help the monarch. And you know, one thing I always say, it's easy in your own lives to help pollinators and monarchs. You plant milkweed and nectar sources, and you're careful with insecticides or don't use them at all is really what you should be doing. But you can also help with your pocketbook. You can not buy genetically modified food. You can buy food at farmers markets, buy food close to home, support your local agricultural community. And this is one way that you can, with your pocketbook, help monarchs, help bees, and as well as all the other pollinators out there.
Let's talk about bees for a moment, because bees are incredibly important as basically, I mean, they are what gives us the plant foods that we eat. Without bees as pollinators, we don't have anything like the food system that we need.
That's exactly right. So oftentimes when people try to simplify things, they don't get it right. But in this time they did. 1 in 3 bites of food that you eat likely comes from a pollinator. And those pollinators are almost all insects. Now, a lot of people don't realize that the honeybee is a non-native insect. We brought the honeybee with us from Europe. It was brought on sailing ships and then moved across the country on wagon trains. And we actually have 4,000 species of native bees in North America, many of them actually really important crop pollinators. So when we're thinking of bees, I like people to expand their horizon. Honeybees are very important for our agricultural systems, but relying on one animal for our pollination is really not a sustainable way forward, and we should be looking to honeybees as well as bumblebees and all of the other native bees as part of the pieces of the puzzle.
We're talking to Scott Black of the Xerces Society about monarch butterflies. Another thing that I think is important to talk about and to think about is coexistence. We seem to have this idea that everything should be, well, monocropping is a great example of that. You've got your corn here, and you've got your houses here, and you've got your roads here. But in fact, in nature, everything is always jumbled together, and it works best that way. You could have flowers among corn plants. You could have milkweed in all kinds of places on the sides of fields. And these things, I mean, it doesn't, and you can have housing developments with flowers and milkweed in the field or in the courtyard. So it doesn't have to be that having real estate development or agriculture means that you're going to lose monarch butterflies.
Yeah, and it's a great point that the story of the monarch butterfly is tied in large part to the growth of agriculture, as is the honeybee. And you know what's really interesting about the honeybee is we've had honeybees in the United States since the 1600s, but nobody ever thought to use honeybees to pollinate crops until the mid-1900s. And the reason is it used to be that crop sizes and natural areas were jumbled together and pollination just happened. In the 30s and 40s, with the advent of large blocks of habit or of crops, so monocultures, and the use of organophosphate insecticides and other types of insecticides, basically people started to see that the crops were not getting the pollination they needed. So somebody said, oh, we could use honeybees. Honeybees are really well suited to be boxed up, to be moved across the country, and to provide a pollination service. That said, in the long term, I'm just not sure how sustainable that is from a food security point of view, to have one animal that has to be carted around the country. It has to show up at the right time so it can pollinate the right crop. And we really need to be moving, I think, forwards, which to me is backwards, to systems that are closer to home and systems that really look broadly at these ecosystem functions and not quick fixes. And I think we get ourselves into these messes because we want the quick fix. We want the one herbicide that will control all the weeds. We want the one insecticide that will, you know, kill all of the pest insects. And all of these systems are really complex, and really it behooves us to take a step back and work within nature to improve how we produce our food.
I read a book once, and we talked about it on this program, about almonds and how they basically bring trucks, like semi-trucks, full of pallets of honeybees. They take them prematurely out of hibernation, and then they let them pollinate the almond trees in that moment when they're in flower. But of course, honeybees don't want to live there because they're only flowering a couple of weeks out of the year, and then they take them away to the orange trees in Florida, and these bees are being carted around in some kind of crazy way and working very hard. And I found myself thinking, wouldn't it be more economical for them to plant flowers that bloomed at different times in their almond groves? I mean, are there solutions like that that you've been looking at?
Yeah, you know, we are looking at those solutions. So we have a major almond producer in California who's working with us to see if we can bring flowering plants into the almond orchards and bring in the bees that we need to actually do the pollination that's necessary. Now, we won't be able to remove honeybees right away, and there are some issues with how early almonds bloom, because almonds are not native to that part of California, and they bloom earlier than some of the native bees come out. But we actually are seeing quite good success in using habitat to do at least part of the pollination, so that potentially not as many honeybees would be needed down the road.
What are some of the other strategies that you're using for preserving monarch butterflies?
Well, to preserve monarch butterflies, as I said, we need to develop the information and tools to help people understand what to do. And the neat thing about monarch butterflies and pollinators in general is that anybody can take action. It doesn't matter whether you have a small backyard where you want to plant flowering plants and a milkweed or two, or you manage a farm and want to do a flowering strip along the edge, or you're a highway manager and want to manage and restore roadside habitat. Anybody can take action, and really it's simply providing the food that these animals need, which is flowers that bloom from spring to fall, add milkweed, and then make sure that you don't poison that, or that you're not putting it in a place where your neighbor will poison that. And then we like to add, think about, you know, the milkweeds, you're thinking about the host plant for the monarch. You can add all sorts of other plants that are host plants to other butterflies, and you can add you can think about your system to add areas where native bees will nest on top of that. So and then the last thing we say is, and then tell your neighbor, because your neighbor will be interested if you're tearing out half your lawn to put in wildflowers. They're going to either be horrified or excited, something. And it's a great opportunity to talk to them about these issues, let them know why you're doing it, and tell them how they can help.
I've always thought that suburbia had tremendous potential as habitat.
It has tremendous potential. And, you know, you don't have to remove every scrap of yard. We live in a human, you know, we're humans, and we like you know, I like the swing set for my kids, and a little bit of grass is fine. But you can provide much of your yard with this beauty that I think is so much nicer than having these vast expanses of green that use a lot of water. And, you know, in California, what we're seeing, which is really interesting with the drought, is that people are having to rip up their yards. So the native plant folks have a real opportunity, and they are taking it to talk about, well, you don't want to use water-loving grass. Here's all these plants that are both beneficial for pollinators and are drought tolerant. Better for all of us, including the animals that will come in and use them.
And are beautiful.
You know, having flowers that spring, bloom in the spring and the summer and the fall. You know, we just moved, and we're starting with a new palette at my household that we're going to recreate. But our old house was flowering pretty much all year. And I have to say, for the most part, the neighbors loved it. They just would come over, and we were unique in the neighborhood. And some of the neighbors even started to emulate on a little smaller scale to do that as well. So, yeah, and people would always say it's the most beautiful yard in the neighborhood. They called it a yard still. It's the most beautiful yard in the neighborhood. And the front of our house had absolutely no grass in it.
Did you see butterflies in it?
Butterflies, bees, if, you know, that's the other neat thing about planting this habitat. And I was talking to someone just today about how they planted a pollinator garden, and they were amazed that within weeks to a little over a month, they were seeing so many more bees and butterflies visiting. It's that old adage, plant it and they will come. And so you've got both the flowers, which are beautiful, and then these flying flowers, if they're butterflies or bees, that are flitting among the plants. And what I tell people, if you're interested in doing this, one, the Xerces Society has a tremendous number of resources to help you. But then when you're done, I always tell people, once the flowers start flowering, get your nice lawn chair, get your favorite drink, and actually sit down and look at the flowers and look at the amazing number of flower visitors. We walk through life without really looking a lot of times, so we don't see the amazing diversity that's right around us. And so, you know, whether it's a pina colada or whatever drink you like to drink, just sit and ponder. It's probably good for your heart, good for your soul.
Takes your blood pressure down.
It takes your blood pressure down, and it's a great way to see the animals that are now visiting the habitat you created.
Are you raising your kids to see in that way?
We really are trying to do that, and it's difficult. You know, we're in this day and age, we're bombarded by media. Everybody, you know, there's the apps and the games and all of that. But my kids really, I think I'm lucky. We tried, but I also think I'm lucky that they want to be outside. They want to see what's around. My youngest son loves to muck around and look for frogs and bees and butterflies and loves to read books, for goodness sakes, rather than just watch videos. So I think we all need to, you know, this is part of changing really how we focus on life, and if we change that focus, our kids are going to see that, and I think they're going to learn from that example. There may be some teenage years where you're not sure what they're going to turn out like, but we hope that they'll always come back in the end.
How did you get into this line of work yourself?
Well, I was the kid who grew up looking under rocks, looking under, you know, in the bushes, rummaging around, looking for animals. I'm the kid who, on the way to school in second grade, found a nest full of baby garter snakes, put them in my pocket. There were about 15 of them, took them to school for show and tell. As they got warmer and warmer and warmer, got up for show and tell, tried to take them out, and 15 or 18 baby snakes went all across the teacher's desk, all across the floor, went slithering across the classroom. I got in big trouble. But that was me. I love nature. And I was also brought up, my dad had an ethic that wild areas, that wilderness, that wild landscapes were really important. And luckily, that stuck with me.
We're talking to Scott Black, Executive Director of the Xerces Society. Tell us more about what the Xerces Society does.
Well, the Xerces Society works on, as I said, the bottom of the food chain. So we work on everything from snails to tiger beetles, from bumblebees to butterflies, and anything else in between. So as long as it's an invertebrate, which basically just means that it doesn't have a backbone, the Xerces Society will focus on it. We've got several major programs working on aquatic ecosystems, trying to understand and better manage our aquatic ecosystems, from everything from stoneflies to dragonflies and freshwater mussels to freshwater snails. We work on we empower citizens, and so our goal is to really, at the end of the day, to empower a broad cross-section of society to either take action directly through planting habitat, or to be involved in citizen science through our Bumblebee Watch program or our Migratory Dragonfly Partnership, which we are getting citizens to help us understand migratory dragonflies, which to me is fascinating. Most people realize monarchs migrate, but we've got 5 species of dragonflies in North America that also migrate. We don't know whether, with climate change and loss of wetlands, whether they'll start to be impacted. And so getting that information now helps us to make those decisions. And then we work through, we advocate, and we work through policy arenas to ensure that our decision makers are taking action, whether it's to better manage how pesticides are approved, to get habitat on the ground, to protect our endangered species. So we're working on this huge array of animals in very many different ways. But really, the goal is taking science, putting it in the hands of citizens, so that those citizens can actually take action in their own lives.
If somebody's listening now who wants to be part of the Citizen Science Program, I don't know if you're active in New Mexico, but can they get involved?
They can, and we are active in New Mexico. All of our citizen science, or most of our citizen science programs, are nationwide. They can go to our website, which is just Xerces, Xerces.org. And if you're interested in bumblebees, type in bumblebee citizen science, or just bumblebees. It's actually likely on the front page. Or dragonflies, or simply citizen science. We have a whole page on citizen science. They can be involved in the citizen science that Xerces does, but we actually have a page that has a lot of other citizen science projects from across the United States, because our goal, of course, is to get people to care about these animals, whether Xerces is managing the project or somebody else.
How did you come up with the name Xerces?
Well, I did not come up with the name. The Xerces Society is named after the first butterfly known to go extinct due to humans, the Xerces blue butterfly. And as San Francisco expanded during the war effort in World War II, they built on the last of that butterfly's habitat. And Robert Michael Pyle, who's a noted lepidopterist and naturalist and founder of the Xerces Society, felt that there should be an organization out there. He loved nature. He loved conservation. He, of course, loved the organizations that were working on tigers and bears and the charismatic megafauna, but he felt there should be an organization that worked on the bottom of the food chain, and he thought naming it after the first butterfly to go extinct would be appropriate. And Robert Michael Pyle is still involved in the Xerces Society. He's a huge advocate for us and for butterfly conservation.
Scott Black is executive director of the Xerces Society, which is on the web at xerces.org, xerces.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a delight.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.